Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
On this week's episode of White Wine Question Time.
I remember us having a meeting where we talked about it, and this was really important in shaping what The Last Leak became, because we had this meeting and went, we can't do jokes about this. There's nothing funny here, and we shouldn't be trying to do jokes about this, but we need to talk about it. It was the weirdest thing. I've turned up at the Opera House and Billy Connolly's out the front just having a look in the gift shop. And I kind of wandered. I wandered over and said, oh, Mr. Connolly, I'm here to see your show tonight. And he's like, all right. I said, do you get nervous? And he went, I remember him saying, "No, it's not so much nervous as anxious." I think the world of Twitter and online media and clickbait has led us to a world where we think that if someone's offended online, then that's the end of the world.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is something of a rare find, a comedian who balances his wit, grit and humour, passing comment on the issues of the day live on The Last Leg, and yet all the while still manages to come over as a truly nice guy. His comedy is rarely unkind, and if it is, well, it's usually at his own expense. By the time he washed up on our comedy shores from his native Australia, he was already an established comedian and broadcaster, having honed his craft as a comedy writer on breakfast radio and then as a stand-up before many years going on to host the Aussie TV quiz show Spicks and Specks, which is where he met his wife, Australian opera singer Ali McGregor, when she appeared as a guest. Born and raised in Sydney, he made a name for himself outside of Australia with his own blend of observational comedy and heartfelt storytelling, performing at comedy festivals around the world. In 1997, he made his first appearance at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and went on to earn three consecutive Perrier Award nominations for his shows there from 2001 to 2003. But it was his appointment as the anchor of Channel 4's The Last Leg in 2012, which began its life as part of the London Paralympic coverage before morphing into an irreverent take on current affairs, that truly changed the game for him. As well as his work as a host and a stand-up, he's also the host of Super League rugby coverage for Channel 4, a sport he continues to play, and is a passionate advocate for disability rights, having been born without a right foot. Oh, and he's also a recent and very successful children's author. He lives with his wife Ali and their two daughters between their homes in Melbourne and London, and I cannot wait to talk to him. Let's dial him up, shall we? It's Adam Hills.
That guy sounds great.
He's good, huh? I like him.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
It felt like a This Is Your Life episode. It's really, in a really lovely way.
So, a guest recently described it as an obit.
No, you had too much of a smile in your voice for it to be an obit.
I could do the cocked head sympathy.
If that, yeah, well. If that was an obit, then you were strangely happy about me dying.
But it's, I think it's always really nice. I mean, certainly for the listener, I always try to lay out the life of the guest so that they know exactly what they're diving into for the next hour. Because it's a huge commitment to give someone your ears for an hour. But also, I have found across the course of making this podcast that for a lot of guests, it reminds them of things that they'd completely forgotten about their life and times.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there was anything I've forgotten. I mean, I think being a stand-up comic, but being, I don't know, possibly of the mindset that I am, I you know, live in the moment is a great way of looking at it. But you're never comfortable with your career. You're always looking at, oh my God, what's next? What's the next gig? What's the next show?
Yeah.
And often in a kind of fearful way of, oh, I hope I don't screw that up. Oh, I really need to get this one right. And so every now and then to take a step and look back and think about, you know, to hear all of that laid out in front of you, it kind of makes me go, oh, yeah, right. Okay. No, okay. Maybe I know what I'm doing.
You really, well, you certainly read that way from really kind of, you know, an unusual start writing jokes for a breakfast radio show. I've never known that job to exist, even here, where breakfast is obviously one of the biggest shows on the networks.
There was a thing in Australia, and there still is to be fair, that breakfast radio became quite huge in Australia, probably in about the 80s, I think. Mm-hmm. And then by the 90s, it was enormous. And I know that there were like radio consultants from Australia that would come over here or that would go to the States to kind of tell them how to do breakfast radio. But in particular in Australia, like I remember being in my teens and listening to a guy in Sydney called Doug Mulray, who was just your proper... And I mean, I guess the same happened here with people like Kenny Everett. Like, I grew up loving Kenny Everett.
Yeah, of course, and he was a Capital Radio DJ. Everyone forgets that.
Absolutely. The Kenny Everett Show was virtually a radio show just that had been transposed onto TV.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I loved that idea of radio comedy and that style of live comedy. And really, the radio job in Sydney came about because a friend and I, a comedian called Belinda Franks, we were supporting Britain's naughtiest hypnotist, Peter Powers.
Peter Powers.
Peter Powers was Britain's...
Just tell me that's not his real name.
Well, it's Paul Powers is his real name.
Oh, shut up.
So Peter Powers came out to Sydney, and to be fair to him, the promoter was terrible. The promoter didn't promote the show properly. Got Belinda and I on as the support acts, and it was an amazing show. Like it was, you know, getting men to think they were giving birth on stage or apologise to their wives. So oh yeah, it was incredible. But it ended up after a week and a half having to close again. Like I said, because the promoter was terrible. I know Peter's gone back to Australia and since toured successfully.
Good.
So it's not him. And so Belinda and I found ourselves. We'd only been doing comedy for maybe 2 or 3 years at that point, sitting up late one night depressed because we didn't have a gig to go to because the run had been cancelled, drinking coffee at like, you know, 11 o'clock at night in King's Cross in Sydney thinking, well, now what do we do? And we basically said, you know what? Why don't we apply for a job on a radio station? Why don't we wait until the morning papers come out? Because they used to come out at like 1 a.m.
Yeah. Especially in the King's Cross area, because same with the King's Cross here, you used to go to get the first editions around 1:30 a.m.
Absolutely, yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes,
old school.
We went right. Let's stay out till, I mean, probably fueled by coffee. Let's stay out till 1 a.m. and we'll get the papers and we'll go home. And we went back to Belinda's place and we wrote a whole bunch of jokes based on what was in the papers, and then we faxed them. I mean, you might need another podcast to explain to some listeners what a fax machine was. We faxed them to the number 2 radio station, not the number 1, because number 1 was Doug Mulray, was the guy that I grew up listening to. But we thought, well, no, he's number 1. He doesn't need more jokes. He's not going to look for comedy writers. Go for number two. They're the ones that are going to be going, right, how do we get to number one?
Yeah.
So we faxed them a whole bunch of jokes. I went home, Belinda went home, and then the next morning I got a call from the producer of the radio show saying, we really like the jokes you sent in. Is that your way of applying for the job? And I went, what job? And he went, the job that we advertised in the paper for over the weekend for a comedy writer. So complete coincidence. We didn't know that they had applied for comedy writers. We just sent in a whole bunch of jokes. And so everyone else that applied sent in a resume. They said, well, this is what I've done and this is what I can do. We just faxed in 2 pages worth of jokes. Like one of which they actually used on the show that morning. And so he said, we, you know, and I went, oh yeah, the job that was in the paper. And he said, well, you guys are great. Do you want to stay on as freelancers and just keep sending us jokes and we'll use whatever we can and we'll pay you for every joke that we use? And so I guess over the next couple of months, excuse me, we would you know, get together 2 or 3 times a week or over the phone. We'd write jokes, we'd send them in. And then when the new year came around, they basically said, you know what, let's get rid of the old writers. Let's bring in these new guys. And so they took us both on as writers, and within a week they tried to get rid of us.
Did they? Why?
Yeah, because we didn't know what we were doing. We had no idea what we were doing.
You just gave good facts.
Yeah, but the old writers were so bitter about being kicked out that they didn't want to come back. So they kind of were stuck with us. And then in the meantime, we slowly worked out how to write jokes for radio. So that's – and at the time – The new radio hosts that they had brought in was a guy called Paul Holmes, who was a great DJ, and a children's puppet called Agro.
We had a similar vibe here with Zig and Zag, but they were on breakfast television and they were offensive and Irish.
Yes, there you go. So I guess similar to that. So, yeah. So we were writing jokes for a puppet.
Yeah. But in some ways that's so much easier, right, because they can say anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Except it's a puppet on radio, so no one can see that it's a puppet.
Oh, yeah, it's not. Yeah, no, I get you. Yeah, visually, it's not working, is it?
But, and so I guess after, you know, just a little bit of chutzpah and a little bit of, you know, dumb luck and a little bit of being proactive, that's really what this industry is about. Like
initiative.
The amount of people who sit around and think, well, you know, how do I get into TV or how do I get a job on, you know, in comedy, we do it. You've got to make it happen yourself. And like I said, we got lucky and we stuck at it. And then I guess after about a year and a half of that, they then asked me if I would move to Adelaide and kind of go on air. Because gradually I started doing characters on this radio show as well, or sketches or whatever else. So it was an amazing learning experience because you're doing it live every day. You start work at 4:30 in the morning and you've got to have sketches on air within 2 hours.
It's exciting though, isn't it? I love that kind of adrenaline and the deadlines.
And it's really not that far from what I do now on The Last Leg. Like, well, Leg is virtually a radio show live on TV.
Totally. It was the ultimate apprenticeship for what was to come.
Oh, 100%. Because then I went from there to Adelaide, and then I co-hosted The Breakfast Show in Adelaide for a couple of years, and then I hosted my own morning show for a while. So all of that stuff, you know, getting people to call in, responding to the news as it comes in, during ad breaks, all of that kind of stuff is still exactly what I do in The Last Leg now.
It really is, isn't it? And you do it so well. I mean, 2012, you had what, 7 shows commissioned? Was it 7 shows? Or 7 months?
Oh, it's either 7 or 9 for the Paralympics. Yeah. I can't quite remember. But, and again, that is, so there was a moment in about 2004, when I was asked to go back to Australia and host this music quiz show, and things were going quite well for me over here. As you said, I'd been nominated for the Perrier Award. I was making appearances on TV shows, and I was asked to go back and host Spicks and Specks, this music quiz show. So by the end of that, by the end of 7 years, 270 episodes of hosting that show, you know, then I was asked to come over and do the Paralympics, and It didn't feel like too much of a stretch for me hosting the Paralympic show. It was live. It was about disability sport, which I love. It was about the Paralympics, which I love.
Were you playing sport then as well? Were you doing the rugby?
I wasn't doing the rugby then, but I had played, you know, when I was in my teens, I played loads of tennis. I was a tennis coach for a while. I played rugby when I was at high school. So, Yeah, I mean, even when I was at, when I left high school and went to university, I studied to be a journalist. Like, I wanted to be a sports journalist. And funnily enough, after a few days of doing the last leg, Josh and Alex and I started chatting, and we all wanted to be sports journalists.
Did you?
Well, Alex was. That's how they found him. He was a sports journo. Josh studied at college because he wanted to be a sports journalist, and so did I. So the three of us all then coming together for the last leg was a little bit of magic and luck, again, all thrown in together.
It really was. And then they had, whose decision was it, once the Paralympics were done, to keep it going and to turn it into a topical take on the news?
Well, there was a funny... So after we did our first episode, again, we didn't know what we were doing. We were still rehearsing. In fact, I remember 5 minutes before we went to air, the producer said, right, we can rehearse part four or you can go to the loo, but we don't have time for both.
I've been there, Adam, when you've done that. The first time I hosted the X Factor final, we hadn't rehearsed the results show ever.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm with you. There is no toilet break that's going to help you in that moment.
Oh, no. I took the toilet break.
Shut up. I stood there and absolutely wet myself.
No, I can get through anything on an empty bladder. So,
so go on, he's in your ear.
So we did the show and, you know, it went relatively well. And the next morning they said, look, I remember the ratings were something like 900,000. I had literally no idea if that was good or bad. Yeah. I had no idea. And then I got a call from one of the writers. I was on my way in and he said, right, you better come in quick because there's a meeting here. I think we're in big trouble. And so I walked in and there was a meeting and there was a commissioning editor from the channel and everyone was like ashen faced. And she ran through all the things that were wrong with the show and all the things that needed fixing. And I found out later it's because the channel watched the first episode and went, oh my God, this is great. We can really turn this into something. Let's get a commissioning editor involved. Let's turn this into an entertainment show. There could be a future here. But it didn't feel like it. It felt like we were naughty school children and we were being chided for not
doing
it. So the only thing was, I think as we left that meeting, someone else from Channel 4 said, what are you doing after the Paralympics? And I went, oh, I don't know. I think at that point I had planned to go to New York for a month and be the compere of the Comedy Cellar in New York.
Right.
And I said, oh, I don't know, I might be going to New York. Why? And she said, don't talk to anybody else before you talk to us at Channel 4. And I remember going, oh, that's, I thought you didn't like the show. I thought we just got in trouble for the show. Okay. And so I think even before the Paralympics had finished, I'd had a meeting. I remember having a meeting with Jay Hunt, who was the head of Channel 4, with my manager, a guy called Addison Cresswell.
Oh, and, the late, great Addison Cresswell.
Yeah.
Oh.
So you know what? He was like a cigar-smoking force of nature, all right, copy wide boy type thing.
We need more characters like him in the business. Addison, you could hear reverberating down the alleyways of Soho when, you know, by 4 o'clock he was in the Groucho and effing and blinding at everyone, yeah.
Well, so we're sitting in this meeting with like the head of Channel 4, who I've never met before, and she was saying, and she was lovely, and she said, I'll be honest, Adam, I've never seen an audience connect with someone the way they've connected with you so quickly. Dude, like, people are really connecting with you, and I think you could do big things. I've just never seen this happen before. She's also part Aussie, so there was an Aussie twang in there. She said, and then she looked at Addison, she said, I mean, if we're going to talk contracts, I probably shouldn't be saying all this in front of you, should I? And he looked at her and went, it's all right, darling, keep talking. I'm just watching his fee go up. And what I loved about them both was she then looked at me and went, excuse me, Adam, for a second, looked back at Addison and went, fuck off, you pig.
Did she really? Went,
can we continue? And I thought, I'm loving all of this. That my manager is that, you know, brash. I'm loving that the head of Channel 4 is quite happy to put him back in his place. I want to work with both of these people. So it all came together. But I swear to God, we had a meeting with Channel 4 where they said, what kind of show do you want to do? And I went, well, why don't we do a weekly disability sports roundup? Like, no one's ever done that before. And it can morph into talking about the news as well. But why don't we pitch it as a Friday night disability sports show that occasionally covers the news? And they went, we love it. And then we signed the contract. And then they came back and went, right, so it's a weekly satirical news show.
Nothing to do with people with disabilities.
It's like, I thought we were doing disabilities. And in fact, early doors, there was the weirdly, there was a kind of feeling from the channel when we started of don't talk about disability sports. In fact, don't talk about disability or sports. We want this to be a news show. And we want it to be live because that seemed to work during the Paralympics. But in the first couple of weeks that we would talk about disability or we talk about sport and they go, no, we're not a sports show. We're a news show. And we're not really a disability confused. Show. Weirdly, on about episode, I'm going to say episode 3, maybe episode 4 in 2013, Oscar Pistorius shot Reeva Steenkamp and it was the biggest news of the week. And so suddenly the biggest news of the week did combine disability and sport and Paralympics.
In a way that as well, that really you were uniquely placed to break down that story because yes, he was a sports hero. He was a hero and a villain in that moment.
Mm.
And it brought him to people's attention that maybe may not have even been aware of him before.
It was kind of it was remarkable for so many reasons and it was horrific. Like, let's start with that as the baseline.
Mm.
But it was remarkable that a Paralympian was front page of the papers for anything, especially, in a weird way, it showed that disabled people aren't just the inspirational heroes you see at the Paralympics. They're everyday people. They're superstars. They're newsworthy. They make mistakes. They do bad things. Like, there's so much more to Paralympians than just, oh, the guy with one leg has done something amazing.
Mm.
And I remember us having a meeting where we talked about it, and this was really important in shaping what the last leg became, because we had this meeting and went, we can't do jokes about this. There's nothing funny here. And we shouldn't be trying to do jokes about this. But we need to talk about it. So let's be honest and let's just say we're not going to do jokes about this.
Mm.
And I think because we'd come from covering the Paralympics where, again, you can't just mock the Paralympics. Do you know what I mean? You have to celebrate achievements and the sporting achievements and you have to take it seriously and then you can have a little bit of fun. So I think that bought us the license with Oscar Pistorius and Reeva Steenkamp to talk about it genuinely and seriously, which we did for the first week. And then, of course, it rumbled on week after week after week. And then eventually we could go, okay, well, let's talk about, okay, if you thought you heard a burglar in the middle of the night, would you put your prosthetic legs on? And if you went to jail, would you take your prosthetic legs with you? And would they be considered dangerous? And so then we started to find...
Funny.
The light in a really, really heavy story. And I think ever since then, no matter what was thrown at us, Charlie Hebdo, Westminster attacks, Joe Cox, whenever a horrific story happened, we knew, okay, we've almost got a template for this. Let's be genuine. Let's talk about it seriously and let's try and find the light. And so that, weirdly, that Oscar Pistorius story set us up for how to cover the news from there on in.
I think so much of that, though, Adam, sits with you. It's your tone. It's you've created the playing field on which the others could play, and you do it so well. And that's something that, you know, you hark back to what Jay Hunt saw about you in that meeting. And I get it, right? There is just a connection to you. But I've wanted for my first question to talk to you about some of the important connections that you've had with others. So are you ready?
Okay, let's go.
We've just heard there that Jay Hunt was a big game changer in terms of your career. You had a force like Addison Cresswell behind you. But also, I know that just when you needed it most, a kind of guardian angel appeared in your path in the shape and size of Billy Connolly. So I just wondered if you could tell me about some of the people that have been formative in terms of putting you here today where you are.
Everyone. Shall I start with Billy Connolly?
That's a very good place to start.
Okay. I refer to him as my hairy godmother.
Great.
So I first met Billy Connolly out the front of the Sydney Opera House in about 1989. I had gone there to see him do a show. And it was the weirdest thing. I've turned up at the Opera House and Billy Connolly's out the front just having a look in the gift shop. And I kind of wandered, I wandered over and said, "Oh, Mr. Connolly, I'm here to see your show tonight." And he's like, "All right." I said, do you get nervous? And he went, I remember him saying, it's not so much nervous as anxious. You know, I just want to be on stage. But I went and saw him live and he was amazing that night. And then about 3 or 4 years later, I was in Adelaide. I was on radio. The radio station was sponsoring his live show. And so the radio boss said, do you want to, you know, we're running a competition for people to go backstage and meet him. Do you want to take them? I know you're a big fan of Billy Connolly. And I went, oh my God, yeah. So I went backstage and these people met him and they all clammed up. None of them spoke. And he didn't know, he didn't know what to say, basically. And someone said, oh, this is Adam. He's from the radio station. And he went, oh, Ray, are you on radio? And I said, well, I'm actually a stand-up comic. And he went, oh God, did you like the show? And I went, oh my God, I loved it. I said, I was learning so much. And he went, it gets easier as you go along, you know, you learn. And he started giving me advice.
Coaching you, and brilliant. And we
posed for a photo and then the camera wasn't ready. And he went, oh God, the amount of times you'll spend in your life waiting for a punter's camera to get ready, you know. And at the end of it, he walked off down the hallway going, just do it. It's the best job in the world. You'll love it and you'll hate it, but you'll love it. Just do it. Just never stop. Just do it. And so that all rang in my head. And I remember a few years later, in fact, maybe a year later, I was kind of asked if I wanted to, I basically had to make a choice between radio and stand-up. Mm. And I remember the boss of the radio station saying, look, you've got to choose one because you can't commit either to either of them at the moment. And I had Billy Connolly's little voice going, just do it. Just do it. So I went, right, I'm going to go to Edinburgh. I'm going to do the Edinburgh Fringe. I'm going to, you know, start basing myself in London, which I did. And then maybe 3 or 4 years later, I was at the London Comedy Store. I was the last act on that night on an amazing bill that was like Mickey Flanagan, Mandy Muden, Dara O'Brien and me. And Billy Connolly came in during the interval to watch the show. And I was the last act on. So I went on stage and told the whole story of him saying, just do it. You need to do it. And I was like, and he's here tonight. And they all turned around and everyone gave him a standing ovation. I said, so thanks to you, Billy. I did it. I'm here at the Comedy Store. Did my set, went backstage. And then he came backstage and he just gave me a hug and went, you did it. You did it. And gave me a hug. I'm proud of you. You did it. And like, hung out backstage with everyone and was just the perfect gentleman. Aww. And then a few years later, I was asked to be on a TV show where people give their, you know, recollections and tell stories of Billy Connolly. And I said, oh, I've got a really good story. And they went, yeah, we know. We interviewed Billy last week and he mentioned it. So that's why we're coming to you to get the story.
He really is your godmother.
He is my hairy godmother. So, but there's, you know, I could pinpoint so many different people along the way. Like, I remember very, very, very early on doing a gig where I was compere of the early show and the late show at the Comedy Store in Sydney. Because I learned I had this skill to compere. Not everyone can. Because you've got to be vaguely responsible. You've got to not steal the limelight. You've got to stick to your time and then you've got to bring on you've got to get the audience in the right spot, then bring on the next act. You've got to ad lib with them. Not everyone can do that. Like, some comics will go out.
You've got to be a funny traffic cop, right?
That's a great way of putting it.
All moving all night. Yeah.
Again, the kind of stuff that I do on the last leg, in a way. Mm. And so what had happened this night was we'd had a full house in the early show. And then the second show, there were only about 50 people, but 40 of them had been in the first show. And they'd seen all my jokes. I had no new material. So I started talking about my prosthetic foot, being born with one foot. And I said, I made a joke. I'd been at a party on the weekend where I said, I've got an artificial foot. And a woman said, can you still have sex? And I thought that was hilarious. And I left it at that and I moved on. And this comedian backstage. I know, right?
What kind of sex is she having?
So there's the interesting thing. At the time, this comedian backstage, a guy called Richard Carter, just said, you're not good enough to talk about your leg yet. And I was like, what? And he went, you're just starting out in comedy. You're still working out how to be funny and what you want to say. And he said, when you work out how to be properly funny and what you want to say about your leg, you'll be untouchable. but you need to ply your trade and work out how to do comedy first before you talk about your leg. Right. And I had an agent at the time, Mark Morrissey, who I mentioned that to, and he said, yeah, I agree. And he said, the thing is, if you talk about your leg on stage now, you'll only ever be known as the one-legged comedian. He said, but if you can work out how to build up a repertoire and kill a crowd first, then you talk about your leg, then it'll just be another string to your bow. So for 13 years of stand-up, I didn't talk about my leg. And it was only after I was nominated for the Perrier Award for the first time. Two things happened. Firstly, I was nominated for the award and I thought, okay, I've now got proof that I might be good at this.
Funny, I've got a certificate.
I've got a trophy, like a nominee's trophy that says maybe I know how to do this. But that was also 2001. And then I would say, what, maybe 2 weeks after the festival finished, not even that, I flew through Heathrow Airport 3 days after September 11 to go to do a gig in Paris. And my foot set off the metal detectors, which it always does. But normally I would just go, oh, it's a prosthetic leg. But there was more tension around because it was 3 days after September 11. And so I thought, right, well, they're going to want to check it. But the guy just got really freaked out and was like, oh, I'm really sorry, mate. No, go through. And I'm like, well, no, I'm happy for you to check. Like, there might be a knife down there. Have a look. And he's like, no, go. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous. Like, this guy is more freaked out. I then wrote a line. I talked about it on stage. And the line was that he had a look on his face that said, I don't care if the plane goes down. I don't want to offend a spastic. And I purposely made that line as offensive as possible because I wanted it to come across that, because he had that look of, I'm so freaked out by your leg that I don't care if the plane goes down. I don't want to offend you. And I don't even know how to talk about you. And I'd probably get the word wrong anyway. So that's why that line was there. And I remember I was living in Dublin at the time, coming back from Paris, going on stage the next week at the International Bar in front of about 30 people and thinking, right, I'm going to talk about my leg because I want people to know that it's okay to talk about it. I don't want security guards to be so freaked out that they might let a terrorist on a plane. And I guess I was being selfish. I was like, I don't want another terrorist being let on this plane.
Imagine.
Because you're too freaked out to check his leg. And so that was the first time I spoke about it. And I guess those two things came together. I finally had proof that maybe I was good at comedy, but I also had a reason to talk about it. And the reason was to say, it's okay. It's okay to ask me about it. Mm. It's okay. And then I remembered that story about the woman saying, can you still have sex? And I told that on stage and then followed it up with what you said, which was, I mean, what does her boyfriend do? Does he have a run-up?
Jump in, my friend. Exactly.
Exactly. And so
long jump.
What had happened in those... So in those 13 years, I'd worked out how to turn something that happened to me into a funny story and find a reason to talk about it. And so then, because also the other thing about having a prosthetic leg that's not visible is audiences, I could feel the audience when I mentioned it would be like, well, why are you telling us this? We can't see it. What? There has to be a reason for you to bring this up. And so when I found that the reason and what I would say to them is, I just want people to know that it's okay.
Yeah.
Then they were like, oh, all right, okay, there's a point here. And then gradually, weirdly, I found, you know, people would come up to me after gigs. I remember a dad coming up to me after the Comedy Store once in London and saying, I've got a daughter who's deaf and I've never found anything funny in it, but you talking about your leg has made me realise that I need to not take it quite so seriously and that it's okay. So, and then weirdly, that is it okay became part of the last leg.
Which takes me beautifully to my next question, because I really wanted to talk to you about what is and isn't okay, if that's okay.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, question number two for you. On the last leg, you started the hashtag Is It Okay, which was a kind of a conversation starter. You wanted to dismantle some of the stereotypes around conversations, like the woman who said to you, you know, can you still have sex if you've only got one leg? And people started writing in or tweeting in saying, is it okay to ask, for example, why some people are competing because they don't look particularly disabled in the Paralympics? Or is it okay to find a Paralympian fit? And did you enjoy being able to kind of pick apart an uncomfortable conversation and give it license?
Well, funnily enough, the producer of the original Last Leg was a guy called Pete Thomas. And he and I sat down with another writer called Adam Vincent, and we were talking about what could be possible segments on the show. And we knew that people would have questions about the disabilities, and we knew that we had to demystify them. And so his name for the segment was going to be Paralympic surgery, but like a politician surgery where people can come along and ask questions. And then, in all honesty, we just forgot to do it in the first show. It was such a mad kind of scramble to pull this show together that we never did it. And then it was probably that night, I looked on Twitter afterwards to see what people's responses were. And someone wrote, is it okay to ask? Exactly. Is it okay to find a Paralympian fit? And then someone else said, is it okay to ask what the disabilities are? Because some of them don't look disabled. So the next day we got into the meeting and I read those out and we were like, oh yeah, this is the Paralympic surgery idea. We should definitely do this as a segment in the show. And then the director, Jules, said, hashtag, is it okay? Yeah. And we went, oh, that's great. That's really good. And it was just, again, a lovely accident that those two questions were both phrased with, is it okay, in it.
Brilliant.
So, and that was it. It kind of took off from there. And
what were some of your favourite questions regarding is it okay?
During the Paralympics, my favourite was, is it okay to ask how a guy with one arm gets out of the swimming pool? Or a guy with no arms gets out of the swimming pool?
Of course it's okay. I mean, is it okay? I mean, I think it's okay.
Of course it's okay. Yeah. But the reason I loved that question is that it came from one of the American wheelchair rugby players.
Ah.
So, another accidental fascinating thing happened. Because we were on live at 10 o'clock every night and the Paralympians all had to go back to their dorms and just do nothing, they're not allowed out, they all ended up watching our show.
No.
So it's been, I remember Sir Philip Craven, who was head of the IPC, on the way to Rio said, you guys are more famous outside of the country than you are in Britain. And he said, you don't realise it because every Paralympian from around the world has watched The Last Leg in London in 2012. And they loved it because they'd never seen anyone do what we were doing before about Paralympics. So to get a question like that from a Paralympian, from the American wheelchair rugby team, saying, is it okay to ask? It made me go, well, great. That means Paralympians are watching it. But it also means for the audience at home, they're like, oh, yeah, of course, disabled people have questions about other disabled people.
Yeah. You don't walk around with a dictionary inside your head with all the, no, an encyclopedia even, and an answer for every disability and conundrum it presents.
So for me, the is it okays that I like the most are the ones that I don't know whether it's, is it okay? And we have to have a discussion about it. And I think the world of Twitter and online outrage and online media and clickbait has led us to a world where we think that if someone's offended online, then that's the end of the world. And when it comes to jokes, you can break jokes apart and you can get very nerdy and mathematically precise about who's the victim of the joke and what exactly is that you're saying and all of that kind of stuff. But it really, most of it comes down to intent.
Yeah.
Who are you trying to make fun of? And even, funnily enough, I was on a chat show in Ireland recently. And I ended up talking about doing a bit that I've done in stand-up, which is I was so excited when I got my first blade prosthetic, you know, like those proper Paralympic blades that look really cool because I'd seen people with blades on TV and I always wanted one. And then eventually they made one that would fit my stump and I was so excited. And then Oscar Pistorius ruined it for all of us.
It was sexy for a minute and then he ruined it.
Exactly. And I said, now I know how Charlie Chaplin felt when Hitler stole his tiny moustache. And that's one of those ones where it's like, oh, God, you just made a Hitler joke. But afterwards,
and a disability joke, by the way. You did it all.
All of them at the same.
It's like bingo.
Well, and a domestic violence joke, if you want to include all of them. But if you go through each of those beats and work out what is being said with each of those jokes, you know, I'm saying Oscar Pistorius ruined it. I'm saying that Hitler ruined it for Charlie Chaplin. Like, it's one of those things where you hear trigger words and you think, oh, God, this is really offensive. And yet if you want to break it all down, I'm happy to say I'm on the right side of...
Right.
You know.
Yeah, on the right side of right.
I think we live in a world where it's okay to be offended and it's okay to own up to it and go, oh, I'm really sorry. Yeah, I shouldn't have said that. I've done that. I've done that on the last leg.
Yeah, we have to be able to apologise and move on, right? You can't just keep cancelling everyone. There's going to be no one left.
No, of course. And the whole thing is, but the idea that there is a cancel culture. Like I did an interview a couple of years ago about cancel culture and I went, tell me one person who's been cancelled really for what they've said. For what they've said. Like, it's not, I don't think cancel culture is a big deal, as big a deal as some people.
I think Sharon Osbourne feels that she was cancelled.
For
backing Piers Morgan's right to have a freedom of speech. Not that necessarily she agreed with what he was saying, just that he had the right to say it.
What was she cancelled from?
The talk, ironically. She was silenced.
Do you know what? I will say that there is an interesting discussion to be had about cancel culture and about how... Because for me, if you look at people like, for instance, okay, say Louis C.K. Well, actually, no, I'll tell you what. We don't need to talk about Louis C.K. Let's talk about Kathy Griffin, Roseanne Barr, and maybe Sharon Osbourne as well. Because it seems to me that the only people that I know that have been effectively cancelled for what they've said have been women. The only examples I can think of have been... Roseanne Barr was a Trump supporter and her show was dropped. Kathy Griffin was very anti-Trump and she had a huge backlash. And you've just brought up Sharon Osbourne. It's the interesting thing. There are very few, if any, in particular white men who've been cancelled for what they've said. I mean, Dylan Moran made a great point. So Louis C.K. was masturbating in front of people that worked for him. He would.
So that's a sexual kind of, abuse.
It was a sense of sexual abuse, and his thing was, well, you know, I asked their permission. But if you're a runner on a TV show, and the guy hosting the TV show, like if I said to one of the runners, "Can you come to my dressing room while I masturbate?" I mean, just the asking in itself is kind of tricky, and if they feel like they have to because I'm the boss, so. And Dylan Moran made a great point. Someone said, you know, does he deserve to be cancelled, blah, 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 blah. And Dylan Moran said, well, okay, imagine you're the best. I think he said, imagine you're the best crocheter in the world and you turn up to the world's crochet championships and everyone's expecting you to win and then you start masturbating in front of people. You're going to have to answer some questions. Like, that's not cancel culture. That's, and look, and my point is...
I think it's actually... Yeah, I think what he's doing is indecent exposure at best. Even if you say you ask for permission, if you're asking somebody who's got no power in that situation to kind of, or feels powerless in that situation, that's an abuse of your own power.
Right. And then he went and talked about it in a stand-up show and filmed that stand-up show. And that stand-up show, I'm pretty sure, won a Grammy. So, and look, this is nothing, you know, like I said, I know Louis C.K. and I've worked with him before. My point is, not only was he not cancelled, he won a Grammy for talking about it. So,
in some ways, we have to have these conversations. We have to talk about them as uncomfortable as they are. And you do it brilliantly on The Last Leg. I mean, there was a clip that, I mean, I, as a woman, I just thanked you for, which was to do with just over 2 years ago now, Sarah Everard, as we know, was kidnapped, raped and murdered by Wayne Cousins, who was a serving police officer. And in the immediate aftermath of her death, there was this kind of shit show of advice that was issued by the Metropolitan Police to women who felt that they weren't safe in the company of a lone officer. And they told them to, quote, run into a house, wave down a bus or call the police if they didn't believe the officer was who they said they were. And the narrative that was going that was amplified, obviously, on social media, which was awash with advice on ways women could and should protect themselves from men, rather than calling upon men to address male violence. And you, quite rightly, were having none of it. You're appalled. And you had your say.
There's also a lot of talk today about what women can do to stop being murdered by men. I think we need to talk about what men can do. Like, for example, calling out inappropriate behaviour from other men. Whether it's someone you work with, one of your best mates, or just some bloke in a pub, if you see something, you need to say something. The man that killed Sarah Everard was known to watch brutal pornography, had been accused of exposing himself to women a number of times, and was known to his previous workmates as the rapist. This week, women have had to imagine their worst nightmare come true. All you have to do is have an awkward conversation with your mate or your mate's boss. It's time for men to step up and call out other men, even over the things that seem little, because those little things can lead to something big. Now, we all know that violence against women is not okay, but laughing about it, dismissing it, and covering up is also not okay. And if you're doing any of those things, you're part of the problem.
The response back from that, well, you tell me, how did it feel to stand up and have a conversation and outline what's not okay?
It's really interesting that you bring that up, because for me, it's funny. Many years ago, I was hosting a concert for the Dalai Lama in Perth, and it was a weird thing. It was a whole bunch of bands all performing, and I was hosting it. But we had an audience with His Holiness, and he came and sat with us. And the one thing I took away from it, which I ended up saying on stage, was I remember him saying, he said, "I am simple Buddhist monk." He said, "I don't know music, I don't know comedy, but I know this. You have a microphone. You should use it to say something." And I've always taken that, and I like that. If you've got a microphone, you should use it to say something. So I think in the week after Sarah Everard's murder and that advice that had come from the police, I mean, look, I have a couple of writers that work with me on The Last Leg. Some of them, you know, some men, some women. So it's good to get and I want that because I want a woman's perspective. But it's such a weird thing because it feels like a no-brainer. Like for me, it felt like, well, it's really obvious that that's what should be said.
And it was, but it wasn't what was being said by the people that should be giving exactly what you said should have been coming from those in authority. It shouldn't have been left to you to say, by the way, you know, if you hear somebody making misogynistic jokes even, or you're on a WhatsApp group where something's posted that shouldn't be said, if you don't challenge it and call it out, you are complicit. And we all have a responsibility. And, you know, being told to cross the road to keep myself safe walking home at night was not the advice I wanted. I was furious and I wanted to go and protest at that vigil in Clapham. And I was hugely encouraged by the number of men there and the number of people that put their own neck on the lines, like Kate Middleton. You know, she went.
Yeah.
That was powerful. She used her microphone, even if she didn't say anything, just by being there. Now, 2 years on, we've had a very depressing report conducted by Baroness Casey into the failings of the Metropolitan Police. Well, you know, where one female police officer said, if in London, if I was raped at the moment, I wouldn't even be bothering to report it. You might as well make rape legal in London, such as the detection rate and the low levels of detection rate. Now, how horribly depressing is that for all of us? You know, all of us.
Yeah.
As the father of two daughters, that must be just the most awful news to your ears. As a 50-year-old woman walking home late at night, it terrifies me. Shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really strange because this is a long roundabout story, but when I first found out we were having kids, I genuinely thought, I hope we have a girl because I'm not equipped to bring up a real man. This literally, and I know,
ridiculous
all of this is. Well, because I'm a goofy comedian who breaks things. I'm not a handyman. I'm not, you know, I've since come round to thinking that, you know, realizing how ridiculous I was. But, you know, as the father of two daughters, there is a part of me that wants to say to them, look, just be careful when you're out, you know, because they're not of teenage years or not going out years. But there's now a point where I think, I look back and think, not that I wish that I had boys, because that's ridiculous. I don't wish I had boys. But if I had boys, then I probably could teach them to respect women. And I think there is something to be gained in having boys and teaching them to treat women the right way. And, you know, because that's... Where does that come from? If you're a boy and you're growing up and you're...
You have to be taught it.
And so it's incumbent for me, it's incumbent upon... Yeah. It's, you know, sexual abuse and rape of women by men is a man's problem, is a men's problem. It's not a women's problem. Women shouldn't have to deal with that. Men have to deal with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where that came from, that men have to try to stop other men and teach your children and, you know, take your mates aside.
But also, take them aside in the pub when they are making a joke that crosses the line and isn't funny. You have to say, you can't say that.
No.
Just going home and going, oh, God, he sounds a bit dated now and, you know... Did you call it out? No. Well, you kind of got to. And yeah, it really is uncomfortable. But trust me, so's trying to find a safe side of the street at 11 o'clock at night when you're walking home on your own. Join me.
Yeah, absolutely. I read an amazing thing once, and I'd have to look it up. It's so long ago, and I'm going to be so vague that it was called Frown Power, or the Power of Frown, or something like that. And it's about when someone tells an off-taste joke, whether it's misogynist or whatever, or racist or whatever. You don't even have to call it out. If you just don't laugh at it, do you know what I mean? Like if I'm in a group of people and I tell a joke that's off colour, if everyone's laughing at it, I'm going to think that joke's fine.
Well, it's validation, right? Yeah.
Yeah. If no one laughs at it, then something in my head's going to go, maybe that joke's not appropriate. Mm. It's such a weird thing. I've done that with cab drivers. I've done that, you know, when someone says something, all you have to do is just go quiet and that person suddenly, then they feel awkward. That's a good starting point, I think.
Yeah, even if you don't feel brave enough to be vocal, just drown just them in silence. Laugh. Yeah.
Don't give them the awkward laugh. Mm. Just kind of just go, uh-huh. And then that person is stuck silently in the front of the cab or in the corner of the party going, oh, my God, I've got to live in this awkwardness that I've just created.
Feeling like a schmuck, yeah.
So it's, there was a point on the last leg where I used to rant about stuff and they kind of went viral. And I remember the channel at the time going, oh, do more of those because they're getting loads of attention and loads of hits on YouTube. And they were, but they had to come from a real place.
Yeah.
You can't just confect because, you know.
Otherwise you're Howard Stern with nothing real to say.
Exactly. Yeah. But then it kind of felt, especially around 2015, 2016, around Brexit, around Trump, that everybody was shouting. And there were a lot of angry people ranting on both sides of the divide.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I started to pull back then because I thought, well, another shouty voice in amongst it all isn't going to help. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I'm getting older. There's nothing, something funny about a young, fresh face ranting, but an older face ranting.
I don't know. You know what? I think when you chose your moment with that piece with Sarah Everard, it was really powerful. And there was nothing funny in it. It wasn't you being a comedian. It was you just being a really good citizen.
Well, thank you. And I think that's for us. Again, it comes from covering the Paralympics, which is a sport that you have to be genuine about. You can't just mock. But it also comes from, you know, radio. Like when you were talking about before about the connections and the people that influenced me, I remember a radio announcer called John Vincent, who was incredible. Some people were just born to do radio. And he was amazing. He used to start each show by saying, "Well, good morning, listener." And I joked with him once and said, "I love that you think you've only got one listener. I think that's a really funny joke." And he went, "No, it's not a joke. People only listen to the radio on their own.
Yeah.
People don't listen in groups.
It's a totally different conversation. Yeah.
So just talk to them as if they're one person." I was like, "Oh, right." But we did a thing. I remember being on radio in Adelaide when the Formula One driver Ayrton Senna died. Mm. And he was huge in Adelaide because at that point the Formula One Grand Prix was in Adelaide. And he was a hero. I think he had won it a couple of times. He was just, and people were devastated. And I remember Vinny saying, we were trying to work out what to do on radio that morning. How do we pay tribute to him? What can we do? We can't be funny. Do we do a sketch? What do we do? And he said, just ask people how they're feeling. He said, just open the phone lines and say, call up, tell us how you feel. And eventually I think we did a thing where we said, if you're driving at the moment, put your headlights on as a mark of respect. And a friend of mine was on like highway and said it was amazing to see all these lights just go on. But
put their hairs on my arms up. Oh.
Yeah, it's just about, it's okay to be genuine.
Yeah, it is. And I think a lot of people shy from it.
And it, especially because we're live, because we are covering, you know, if that had been a pre-recorded show, for instance, and we were talking about the Mets comment, because I reckon the Mets comment about Sarah Everard probably came the night before from memory. I think it was a Thursday night, because I have a feeling, I remember being in the car on the way to the studio calling the producer and we were talking about what we needed to say about it. If that show had been pre-recorded and then went to air 2 days later, it wouldn't have felt as urgent. It wouldn't have felt as necessary. So I think all of those things, you know, being live, having the radio experience, knowing that you can be genuine about a subject, all of those come together.
Yeah.
And you know, so we use the microphone to say something.
As you should. As you should. Thank you so much. That was lovely talking that through with you. Your third and final question, Adam.
Okay.
This one, wait, you're going to have to go with me on this one. It's a little bit dark.
I love any question that starts like that.
Imagine, if you will, that you were sadly to die tomorrow and you find yourself at the pearly gates only to be told that before you cross over to the other side, you can return to Earth for 1 hour. And I want to know, in that 60 minutes, where do you go? Who do you see? What do you say to them? How do you spend your final moments on Earth?
Oh, you're going to make me cry. You really are going to make me cry. Okay, I'm not even going to think it through. I'm just going to say I'm going to see my wife and kids.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
And in particular, my daughters. Yeah, yeah. Just spend time with my daughters for an hour. What would we do? It wouldn't even matter what we did.
Just be
something really banal, like, you know, watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine or drawing. Probably drawing with my kids. I think is my favorite thing to do.
Is it?
And both of them are quite artistic. And I think my favorite moments are, you know, maybe music on in the background, not necessarily, but just drawing. And sometimes my eldest is now 12, but she'll still do it. She'll still create something. I think last holidays we were making stickers together. But I think it would just be sitting around a table with my daughters, just drawing. And for me, I like drawing cartoon characters. So it would be like Mighty Mouse or Banana Man, or I just go online and search Banana cartoon Man. Character and then draw and then paint. And then my, you know, my daughters are scribbling and drawing and just, You know, it's for me, that's what life's about. And it hurts me because I have to spend so much time away from them because, you know, that we were all living together in 2019 over here in London, and then my daughters started getting homesick and my wife was getting work in Australia, and we kind of went, well, that's fine. I can do 10 weeks away at a time and then go back. But my dad worked for Qantas, so he was always away. So I knew what it was like to have a dad that was gone for 2 weeks, but when he was home, he was properly home.
So
with
present.
Nothing in the diary.
Yeah. How lovely.
And like now I go back to Australia in a couple of weeks' time and I've purposely cleared the diary as much as possible. And I remember of all the people who reminded me of this was Frankie Boyle. Frankie Boyle and I were doing a weekend of gigs in Newcastle once.
That great and sentimental fool.
Oh, honestly. So there was a point, there was a comedy club in Newcastle called The Hyena. And when you stayed there, when you played there, they would put you up in an apartment because I think the owner of the club owned an apartment. And so you'd spend a weekend with just some random comic just living together. And I had two weekends in the space of 6 months where it was Frankie Boyle. And Frankie and I would sit up and, you know, we'd go out and I think we were both drinking at the time, but then we'd come back and we'd have cups of tea and we'd talk about the universe. And I remember him talking about how his dad would come home at probably 7 o'clock every night. He'd go to work, go to the pub, and then he'd come home. And I was like, oh my God, that's what dads did. Because my dad didn't. My dad would be gone for 2 weeks and then I'd come home from school one day and he'd be in a beanbag watching, you know, Warner Brothers cartoons, and then that's it. We'd have him home for 10 days. So I guess that's kind of what I've ended up doing with my daughters, which is, you know, it breaks my heart for me to be away from them, but I hope it teaches them that you can have a job that you love and that, you know, there are no boundaries. You can go anywhere in the world and do whatever it is that you love. But when I'm with them, it's just about being with them. And 9 times out of 10, it doesn't matter what you're doing. Just being there. And really being there, as you said, being present is what's important. So for me, that extra hour, just colouring in with my girls.
Yeah. It is this, I think in so many ways, lockdown taught us that. It's the stuff we missed was really just people. It was contact. It was being able to, just being able to touch their skin, hold their hands.
Oh, and, you know, ironically, all I did for 7 months, because Melbourne had the longest lockdown of any city in the world, pretty much. All I did for a 7 months was just colour in with my girls, and I was...
And then you got to work with them. I mean, you took one expression that one of them... one conundrum that one of your daughters presented you with, and you've turned it into 2 best-selling children's books, which you, by the way, have cut them in on, which is pretty remarkable. You've gone 4 ways on the publishing royalties between your 2 girls, yourself, and their chosen charity.
Yeah, it was my youngest who had said to me, and she must have been about 8 at the time, this was pre-lockdown, she said, I don't know when I grow up whether I want to be a rock star or a detective. And I said, well, you do both. You'd be a rock star by night and a detective by day. And it wasn't long after that I was called in for a meeting with some publishers saying, do you have any ideas for books? And in particular, what would you write for your eldest? And I went, oh, she said she wants to be a rock star and a detective, so I'd probably write that. And they went, oh, my goodness, and what would happen in that? And then we started talking about this story. And so... then I came home and I sat with her and went, right, so who would the suspects be and what could the crime be? And we came up with this story of these 2 12-year-olds that are on their first ever tour, music tour, and wherever they perform, a priceless piece of art is stolen, but all the evidence makes it look like they're the ones doing it. So they have to solve the crimes and work out who's framing them. And I said to both my daughters, I said, look, I'm gonna split the proceeds, what I get paid for this, with you guys. And then one of them said, well, no, you should get some as well. And I was like, okay, fine. And then one of the other ones said, well, actually, and let's give some to charity. Let's split it 4 ways. So, and to be honest, like, we've not got around to working out which charity we're going to give it to. I think we identified there's a place in Melbourne called the Song Room, which takes music lessons to disadvantaged schools. Nice. So I think we'll look into that and probably... a disability support charity in the UK as well. But after the first book was written, my eldest said, "I really enjoyed that, Daddy, but can someone die in the second book?" So it turns out kids love murders.
They love a murder.
So this
nice.
The first one's Rockstar Detectives. The second one is Rockstar Detectives Murder at the Movies.
Yeah. So she got her way. Someone died.
She got her way. And I'm trying to make them slightly more gruesome as each one goes along.
You're the perfect man for the job with this, though, because you know how to land a really great message in a really entertaining and compelling and often funny way. And it seems like such a no-brainer that you would write young adult fiction, because 12-year-olds, it's not like you're doing six words on a page and a doodle. This is proper narrative.
It's got to be a proper story. And I mean, I wrote the first story without plotting it through and planning it. And the editor said, yeah, next time maybe, if you're doing a detective story, maybe plan it a little bit. But that idea of if you've got a microphone, use it to say something. Yeah. I've tried to put some positive messages in there. The second one in particular is about how representation matters, because, you know, it's Charlie and George are the two kids, and George is in a wheelchair. But it was important for me to write that in a way that the wheelchair actually makes him a better detective, in that he's faster. There's a chase scene and he's going downhill, but because he's in the wheelchair, he's faster than someone who's running.
Superhero.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I've tried to make it positive and put takeaways in there for the kids that, you know, again, you're just using the microphone to say something.
Yeah. I look for, you know what? My son's like a little bit too old now. He's 14 going on 15. Make the most of it to sit down and read a story like that too. But I used to love bedtime stories with him. And the age that your girls are at the moment, I mean, just hold on tight, because they pull away so quickly. I mean, they come back and they still remain, you know, as captivating and as lovely as ever. It's just different. Teenagers, you know, should come with a manual.
And I can see much well. The teenager's manual. Oh my God.
Before we go, I'd love to come and have dinner at yours one night. And when I say that, I'm not inviting myself to your house. I'm inviting myself and, well, I'm going to make a booking. You've got a restaurant, Adam, not far from where I live.
I have. Oh, is that close to where you live?
Yeah. Well, I'm South London and this is SW6, isn't it? Parsons Green.
It's Parsons Green, and it's so.
Tell me what it's called, because it doesn't sort of scream cuisine. It's called
The Freak Scene.
Yeah, so it sounds like you could go there to be terrorized or fed, but that's not the case. It's kind of Pan Asian punk, isn't it?
It is. So it's this guy called Scott Hallsworth, who he was head chef at Nobu here in London. He set up Nobu Melbourne, and then he had a place on the King's Road called Kurabuta.
So
yes,
good.
You know it. Okay.
Yes, I'm a sushi junkie.
Right.
So you had me at Nobu. Yeah.
Right. So he prior to lockdown, he had a place in Soho called Freak Scene. Uh-huh. And I met him at a Royal Flying Doctor Service charity event, because that's what Australians do. And we became friends, and I would take people to his restaurant. It was my favourite place in London to eat. And then during the lockdowns, you know, it closed. He started up a pop-up last year in Clerkenwell, and I took my wife there. And afterwards he was saying, look, I'd love to get Freak Scene happening again, but, you know, I just don't have the money. I need investors. And it was on the way home, she said, you should invest. You've got a little bit of money. Why don't you? And so I took him out to dinner and said, okay, what do you need? What can we do? And then said, go and do it, because he's the guy that does it. And he's just created this amazing vibe. The food's like deep fried bao buns with red duck curry. It's like tuna sashimi pizza.
I saw some really nice looking, was it yellowtail with jalapenos, and the pita tarki looks good. I have had a look, Adam. I'm not just like blowing smoke up your ass. I'm coming for dinner.
Oh, would you want
to? I've selected my dishes.
Awesome. I'll sort you out. And it's so exciting. And it's all because of him. He's like a rock star of cooking. Right. So it's, but I've spent a couple of nights at the restaurant already since it's open, and I could see. I mean, I'm not drinking at the moment, but I could see how you could ruin your life
as a restaurateur. Oh my God, yeah.
But it's exciting, and it's It's a little bit of magic's happened again.
Adam, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been, well, everything I'd hoped it would be. I've been watching and listening for a long time now, and I'm a huge fan, so thank you.
Oh, it's been absolutely my pleasure, and I can't wait to have dinner with you.
I'm coming. And if you live in the Parsons Green area or in London, or you don't mind driving a bit for some fine food, Freak Scene is available. You can book it on Open Table or wherever you get your dining reservations. And
beautiful.
The two children's books, you've got Rockstar Detectives, A Murder at the Movies, and Rockstar Detective, the original book, are available now wherever you get your books. Ideal gifts for anybody that's pre-teen. Those children that still talk to you.
You're amazing. Thank you so much.
A huge thanks to Adam, his children's books, Rockstar Detectives, Murder at the Movies, and his debut, Rockstar Detective. Both are available wherever you get your books. And if you'd like more conversation with other great comedians, dive into our back catalogue where you'll find episodes with Kerry Godleyman, Griff Rhys-Jones, Daisy May Cooper, Russell Cain, Lee Francis, Rob Brydon, and many more. And good news, we've started dropping an extra mini episode every week now on a Tuesday. It's called Something from the Cellar, and it brings you some of the very best bits from some of our very best guests from the last 4 years. To make sure it lands on your feed, just follow or subscribe to the show. I'll be back next Friday with a great new guest. Until then, thanks for your company.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.